Yeah, so this is some work that I did last year with another postdoc at NYU, David Dunsky, and my thesis advisor, Ben Safdie. So I'm going to talk about axions. I want to briefly motivate why you might be interested in looking for axions. So the axion is a hypothetical fundamental pseudoscalar particle that can solve the strong CP problem of why there's no neutron electric dipole moment and make up dark matter. But actually, the axions I'm going to talk about in this talk don't have to do either of those things. They're sort of a related class of axions that appear in string theory constructions. So there's this notion of the axiverse, where in the process of basically compactifying down from 10 to 4 dimensions, you get potentially many hundreds of axions in the low mass end of your spectrum of nature. And these axions are sort of generically relatively strongly coupled to standard model. And just kind of the class of them is what's known as the axiverse. But all that is going to matter for this talk is that they have some interaction with electromagnetism that looks like this. So it's an axion photon coupling constant, GA gamma gamma, which has units of inverse energy that parameterizes the strength of this AFF dual interaction. And really the physics that I'm going to talk about is easiest to see if you just expand out F and F dual into E and B. In that case, you get that this interaction looks like GA gamma gamma A E dot B. And so you can see that in the presence of some external magnetic field, the axion can mix with the component of the photon that is polarized parallel to the direction of the magnetic field, just because of this dot product here. And basically, these mixing effects are kind of all of the physics I'm going to be talking about, or give rise to all of the physics. So when we think about where and how to look for axions, we typically think about it on this plane of the axion mass versus the axion photon coupling. And broadly, the axion photon coupling has been constrained to be less than about 10 to the minus 10 inverse GeV by this experiment CAST. Although astrophysical probes have improved this bound at particular masses. And this is roughly where you'd expect the axions that live in the axiverse to be, at sort of the region on this plot, or also potentially at lower masses. Today I'm actually going to be focusing on an effort to constrain the axion explanation of this thing called the TeV gamma ray anomaly. I guess I can point the hockey stick. So that's this region shaded in blue, which is the axion explanation of essentially the observation. Okay. I think, well, it's good for now. It's the axion explanation of the observation that the universe is too transparent to TeV gamma rays. So when you take a gamma ray telescope and look at, for example, TeV blazars in other galaxies specifically, what you find is they emit more photons in TeV that you see than you would otherwise expect. And the reason that you don't expect to see these things is essentially that these high energy photons should be attenuated by pair producing on the extragalactic background light as they traverse the cosmological distance between host galaxy and the Milky Way. So basically there should be some high optical depth for high energy photons in the universe. And actually, we see more photons than we would have otherwise expected. And sort of the axion explanation of this observation is that your TeV photons produced in some host galaxy very far away, it mixes with the axion, that is, converts into an axion in the magnetic field of that host galaxy, then traverses the distance all the way to the Milky Way, where it can reconvert in the Milky Way magnetic field. And then you can see that with for example, Fermi gamma ray telescope.
So how large are the typical optical depths? Just like hundreds or thousands? Or
So for a TV, it's the optical depth is typically like 1 megaparsec. And as you get to higher energies, it very quickly decreases to very, very small distances. Like you should really basically see almost zero photons above. Like a TV, you can still see things, but by say 10, 20 TV, you should really see just absolutely nothing at our current sensitivities. And so in this 1 to 10 TeV region, where you kind of have an exponential fall off from this pair production, that doesn't seem to be as steep as existing models suggest. And so the fact that you can have an axion gives you a small probability for any given photon that the optical depth is significantly reduced. Basically, you only have to traverse sort of two distances within each galaxy. And so this increases the number of photons that you expect to see. So the best fit region to explain this anomaly is in blue here. And actually, this is how I kind of started thinking about constraining these axions that might arise from string theory constructions. So a couple years ago, I set this limit here in green based on X-ray observations of magnetic white dwarfs, which is not the same thing that I'll be talking about mainly today, but it's just kind of an aside because there's some interesting stuff I'm doing in this vein currently that I won't have time to talk about in this talk, so I wanted to just carve out a couple minutes.
Why does the best fit region have this shape? Is there an easy way to understand it?
You get these wiggles just because basically in the axion photon conversion probability, you have a sine squared term, sort of a sine squared of mass squared, basically analogous to neutrino mixing. And so you get wiggles as a function of mass. It's a little more complicated than that because it also takes into account modeling of the magnetic fields in these galaxies and so on, but more
is
or less.
Does that remain constant after, or?
At low masses?
Yeah.
So it cuts off, around 10 to the minus 9 EV. And the reason there is if you go to lower masses, then you can also mix efficiently in the sort of intergalactic magnetic field, depending on the value you assume for that. It's, of course, not very well known. And if you're able, so the reason that you had to mix in galaxies specifically is to have photons that are in the axion state over the largest distance possible. But if you can do this mixing in the intergalactic region, then basically you restore a large portion of the optical depth. So it cuts off at low masses for that reason.
So to resolve this problem, or to have axions help with this problem, you're saying that you want the TeV photons to be oscillating into axions inside of galaxies?
Yeah. Basically has to be inside of galaxies.
And these are galaxies that are just like intervening in the line of sight to that TeV source?
No, sorry. So the TeV source is just in some host galaxy. And so it mixes in that host galaxy.
It turned into an axion inside the host and then propagated as an axion for a long time.
Yeah.
And then in the Milky Way turned back to a photon?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
and at low masses, you can mix efficiently in this intergalactic region. At higher masses, that becomes suppressed. So that's why this anomaly is specifically at 10 nano EV or so.
But so each point in the blue region is equally favored, or is there a best point and that's?
I think this is the 1 sigma confidence region, or not 100% sure for some specific model parameters for the galactic magnetic fields.
I guess once you produce a lot of them, you don't care anymore, right? It's like, so basically that region would extend quite far up.
Yeah. Yeah, in principle. I mean, at some point you just essentially remove all of this optical depth.
Unless you know exactly the brightness of the source.
Yeah, so that's like a serious problem with this kind of modeling, is you don't know the intrinsic spectrum of the source, and you're kind of looking at this tail end of the spectrum above the TEV, and you don't really know if it cuts off at some point, or if it's like a power law all the way up to, you know, a PEV or whatever. So that's one of the main uncertainties with this kind of modeling, in addition to the magnetic field modeling, which is pretty difficult to do for extra galactic objects. Right, so a couple years ago I set this limit using X-ray observations of magnetic white dwarfs. And the basic idea here is that axions can be produced inside the cores of magnetic white dwarfs through Bremsstrahlung when scattering processes occur. And the cores of white dwarfs can be quite hot, at least the ones that we're looking at. Once the axion is produced, it can free stream out of the star and traverse the magnetic field of that star and convert into, have some probability to convert into a photon. That photon then has roughly a keV energy, which is just set by the core temperature of this star. So for the white dwarfs we're looking at, that's going to be about a keV. And so, oh gosh. And so we pointed an X-ray telescope at this white dwarf that we determined to be the most emissive in axions and didn't see anything. So we were able to set this limit here in green. But in the intervening couple of years, there's been two new white dwarfs that were discovered that are expected to be more emissive in axions, both because the interior of the star is expected to be hotter and because the magnetic fields present on the surface are larger. And we applied for time to look at these two magnetic white dwarfs and were awarded time in the last observing cycle of this X-ray telescope called Chandra. So one of those data sets has already been taken, and another one we're currently waiting on. So this is something that we'll be able to push down these constraints. Hopefully the next year will be out, depending on when we get that second data set from the second white dwarf. Another interesting thing I'm working on is basically, if you imagine this process can happen at white dwarfs, you can also imagine that it happens at neutron stars. Basically the same thing goes on. You can produce axions through scattering processes in the core. They free stream out of the star and convert in the magnetic field of the neutron star. And interestingly, we looked at archival X-ray observations of seven nearby neutron stars that were not expected to emit in X-rays in the energy range of interest here, which is essentially, again, the core temperature of the neutron star, a couple keV. And we actually found an excess that seemingly looks consistent with the axion model at several of these seven neutron stars. So in this right plot here, I'm showing the spectrum for the neutron star, which we found the most significant excess in, almost 5 sigma, as a function of energy. And overlaid in gray is the axion model, which seemingly reproduces the spectrum that we see reasonably well. Although we don't have, you know, it being only 5 sigma, we don't have a whole lot of spectral information there.
This excess is relative to what? Sorry.
What do you mean relative to what?
It's an excess over something.
This is assuming zero background. So previously these neutron stars are, there are seven neutron stars that are supposed to be special in that they don't produce any hard X-ray excess. So actually the only seven neutron stars known, previous to this work anyway, that had no excess X-ray emission above their thermal emission. So
if you're gonna get into it, that's fine. I had a few questions like, how are you modeling thermal emission?
So the surface thermal emission, these neutron stars have surface temperatures of on the order of 50 EV or so. And so the kind of contamination you get from a 50 EV thermal emitter above 2 keV, which is where we're doing this analysis, is pretty negligible. The emission itself is assuming there's no other backgrounds. And we don't know of any other background that could produce hard X-ray emission at these neutron stars.
Neutron stars have also been seen in X-rays in the form of like pulse X-rays. X-ray
pulsars. Yeah.
I mean, is it not possible that maybe this could be like you don't see like the full beam of the pulsar, but you're getting like off axis?
Yeah, so it's possible in principle. But basically, we also don't see any radio emission from these neutron stars either. So they don't seem to be pulsars. And so there's not really a production mechanism for high energy X-rays that's currently known, that I know of anyway, that could produce the X-ray emission here.
Sorry, just to follow on that. So, but I mean, one of the things about pulsars is you don't expect to see all the pulsars in radio that are pulsing, because there's a certain beam width, right?
Yeah.
So, right. The fact that we haven't seen radio from them doesn't necessarily mean that they're absolutely not pulsars. It could just be our advantage.
Yeah, that's right. But I don't think you expect to see X-ray emission in that case either, right?
Yeah, I mean, not from the direct beam, but.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, there are definitely, like, this is almost certainly something astrophysical. But at the moment, we don't have an astrophysical explanation for this. Basically, the X-ray emission that you get from most neutron stars is sort of rotation powered. And these neutron stars are very slowly rotating. And so if you just kind of sort of naively plot the observed relation between most neutron stars at which you see X-ray emission versus their rotation rate. There's some relation there, and this X-ray emission is much larger than what you would expect to see just based on their rotation rate comparing to other pulsars.
That's cool. So how do you get the rotation rate of these?
So the thermal X-ray emission is pulsed from the surface. That is pulsed because there's some temperature profile on the surface. So, yeah, I mean,
yeah. Get a rotation period. And you're saying that's well below the rotation
period. Yeah, so these are order seconds. 1 to 10 seconds, I think all 10 of these neutron stars are rotating at. Yeah.
Sorry, why you cannot be powered by the magnetic field itself? Why? Yeah. You say that powered by rotation?
Yeah. So I think the other possible mechanism you could have is like inverse Compton. You have electrons in the plasma around the neutron star that you get basically from this magnetic field, which inverse Compton extragalactic background light, or external light into the X-ray range. That's possible. It could be explaining this excess here. But this has been out for a couple years and nobody has provided a full computation of what might be producing this hard X-ray emission. I expect it's probably some astrophysics, but it also looks pretty consistent with an axion model. Basically, if you look at the expected core temperatures of all seven neutron stars, what you see in X-ray, in hard X-rays lines up with your axion expectation. So, in principle, this could be produced by an axion. So it's just something we're thinking about.
It's not excluded by the supernova just because of numbers of luminosity?
Yeah, so you can map this onto a best fit region on the axion parameter space using all seven neutron stars. So this is axion photon coupling times axion neutron coupling as a function of mass. And I mean, normally you don't, like the supernova bound only depends on the axion nucleon coupling. Hey.
From X-rays associated with 1987?
Yes, I think most people think about, I don't think there's a bound on this particular product of the couplings. I think most people are imagining producing axions via the Primakov effect.
I remember people discussing you could produce axions in the supernova, travel outside and decays photons, and then you set a limit on that photon.
Sure, but these are super low mass axions, so they're not going to decay. So that is MeV, capital MeV scale axions. So that just that doesn't apply here. So they're just too low mass. So anyway, the best fit parameter space to explain this lies below the existing couplings on this product of, or the existing constraints on the product of this coupling. And we're thinking about ways to further probe this, and there's kind of an obvious direction to go, which is that most of the flux might actually be produced at higher energies if this is really coming from axion emission. And the reason is that if the neutron star core is superfluid, then you can efficiently emit axions through Cooper pair breaking formation processes. So this is like schematically, you can see this on the right here, where you emit two neutrinos in this process, but you can also do the same thing for an axion. And then these axions are emitted with roughly the gap, the superfluid gap energy, which is of order 10 keV or slightly larger. And that's outside the energy range of the telescopes we were originally using to look for this excess. So the telescopes we had used previously, Exmom Newton and Chandra, this is Exmom Newton here, had sensitivity between 2 and 8 keV, roughly speaking. But what I'm showing here is the expected spectrum for axion emission. In dashed black here is just the Bremsstrahlung contribution. But if you have this superfluidity contribution, then there's enormous uncertainty in what this looks like, but potentially could be orders of magnitude larger, albeit at higher energies. And so what you'd really want to do is look at these neutron stars in with some higher energy X-ray telescope. So there is one such telescope called NuSTAR that has sensitivity in this shaded blue range between about 3 and 80 keV. And it could probe scenarios in which the axion's producing X-rays above this this red line here. And so we actually applied for some time on this telescope NuSTAR and were awarded time. The observation was taken back in October, and we didn't see anything. Unfortunately, that's kind of like the least interesting scenario because, well, you might just be, I mean, it still in principle could be produced by an axion, but you might just be living in a world with some superfluidity model that produces axions below this red line here via Cooper pair breaking. But we now know that we're not living in a world with a superfluidity model that produces many orders of magnitude more axions than the Bremsstrahlung contribution. Okay, so that was kind of an aside. But I'm now going to get to the kind of main thing I was going to talk about, which is these polarization observations. And so we're trying to think about axions that can explain this TV gamma ray transparency anomaly. And if you sort of stare at all of these exclusion curves, what you see is that below a certain mass, they're basically flat. And you kind of reach a critical mass, and all of a sudden they turn up very quickly. And the reason for that is when you're doing axion-photon conversion, if the axion has a large enough mass, then it has a different momentum from the photon and can go out of phase with the photon, at which point you sort of lose coherence in the mixing. And this happens when the inverse length scale of the magnetic field you're converting in is equal to this momentum difference for a relativistic axion, that's ma squared over omega. So for example, like these searches are searches for axions converting in galactic or galaxy cluster magnetic fields, which are really large length scale, and therefore they turn up at a very small axion mass. This superstar clusters bound is something I worked on a couple years ago, looking at axions converting in the magnetic field of our own galaxy, so a little smaller length scale, so it extends up to slightly larger axion masses. But if you want to probe something that lives at axion masses of around 10 to the minus 8 eV, then you need a very small scale magnetic field, relatively speaking, that's also very large. And these are provided by compact objects that are magnetized. So for example, magnetic white dwarfs. And indeed, you can see in this previous search I discussed, that turns up around 10 to the minus 5 eV. So if you want to constrain this TV gamma ray transparency anomaly, you really need to look for axions somehow being converted in the magnetospheres of compact objects.
Can I, before, I didn't want to interrupt you, but in the previous slide, you talked that you can also have neutrinos, right?
So yeah.
Do you happen to know, and they are like 10 keV neutrinos.
Yeah.
Do you happen to know what's the flux of that from a typical neutron star, so compared with the flux of, say, 10 keV neutrinos from the sun?
Off the top of my head, I don't know, but you can't. Well, I would imagine it's the luminosity is larger, but
it's larger.
In terms of luminosity, but I don't think this is something you'd ever be able to see at neutrino detector, for example.
Larger than the sun's luminosity. In 10 keV.
It's hotter.
But the flux would be smaller.
Yeah, just because they're much, much farther away. I mean, it's like, yeah.
Yeah, no, it's just a factoid.
But yeah, I almost sure would be larger, especially for the superfluidity models that emit a lot of axions and also emitting a lot of neutrinos. Yeah. Okay, so the basic idea is that magnetic white dwarfs emit thermal unpolarized radiation from their surfaces, and this then free streams out of the star traverses this magnetosphere. And so you can imagine this thermal radiation has sort of two polarization directions. The polarization direction that's polarized parallel to the magnetic field, that has some probability to convert into an axion. On the other hand, the polarization direction that's parallelized perpendicular can't convert into an axion. And so what you see with your telescope at Earth is an effective linear polarization, polarized perpendicular to the direction of the magnetic field on the surface of the star. So just to make this a little more quantitative, we're thinking about this term of the Lagrangian, but taking the magnetic field to be that of the magnetic white dwarf. And if you lay down coordinates such that x3 is the direction the axion photon system's traveling in, and the magnetic field's in the x2 direction, you have some initially unpolarized light that has a vector potential that looks like this. And by the time it gets to Earth, the two component of that vector potential has been depleted. It's by a factor of one minus the linear polarization. And so here you can see that, you know, X1 is larger, so you have an effective linear polarization perpendicular to the magnetic field. So now we actually want to know how to compute this linear polarization. And it's a little harder than I kind of made it seem previously. And one of the reasons is that you have to include nonlinear effects of Maxwell's equations in your Lagrangian, because these magnetic white dwarfs have very strong magnetic fields on the order of, say, 10 to the 9 Gauss, so basically 10 to the 5 times larger than anything we can make in a laboratory. And what this term does is basically it gives a effective index of refraction to the photon. And this has the effect of reducing the conversion probability that you would have sort of naively expected in the absence of this term. So you can compute the Euler-Lagrange equations for this guy, and you get some mixing matrix that looks like this. And it mixes the axion and the component of the photon parallel to the direction of the magnetic field. The perpendicular direction just kind of is independent of this mixing because of that E dot B. And so what are these terms actually? So delta B is sort of the thing that's doing the mixing. It's GA gamma gamma times B. And delta A and delta parallel are really thought of as the momentum difference between that species and a free photon in vacuum, so no magnetic field. And so this delta parallel guy, effectively, it's like you can think of it as a mass for your photon that's of order omega squared times b squared. And if you imagine you have a dipole magnetic field, that field falls off with distance from the star as 1 over r cubed. So since this has the highest power with b, if you plot these deltas as a function of distance from the star under this dipole approximation, this delta parallel for some values of parameters is largest near the surface of the star, falls off like 1 over r to the 6th, and eventually this delta b term dominates. When delta parallel is large, since this is on the diagonal, it's going to suppress the mixing. When delta B is large, you're going to get efficient mixing. So what you expect, basically, at the end of the day, is that the axions are converted relatively far away from the star, at sort of a order one stellar radii distance. Yeah.
Can you have a resonance with delta parallel?
Right, yeah, so you can't actually. So this is negative, and this is positive. So there's no level crossing. And for a dipole magnetic field with a massless axion, you can actually compute this analytically. And basically, there's two regimes to the solution. One is in the limit of large magnetic fields. So this zeta parameter here goes like magnetic field squared. And that's greater than 1 if the Euler-Heisenberg term is important. So basically, if delta parallel is ever larger than delta A. And it's less than 1 if the opposite case is true, this Euler-Heisenberg term is not important. In that case, you kind of recover what you sort of naively expected, which is the linear polarization is of order 10 to the minus 4. For axion-photon couplings of 10 to the minus 12 inverse GeV. And you get a scaling, like magnetic field squared and some length scale squared. On the other hand, if the magnetic field is large so that the Euler-Heisenberg term matters, you don't get to do as well. So for example, linear polarization only scales like magnetic field to the 2/5 power, just because the photon has a index of refraction. And you can see this here. So here I'm plotting linear polarization as the function of surface magnetic field strength on the star. For low fields, it goes like b squared. And at some point, the Euler-Heisenberg term starts mattering in your mixing. And from then on, you kind of asymptotically go like b to the 2/5 power.
So do these optical photons, like if there's no axion, like they still come out from the surface, right?
Mm-hmm.
So do we know like it is has to be emporized from the surface?
I'll talk a little bit about astrophysical polarization in a couple slides.
So is this effect greater for this white dwarfs than, let's say, magnetars or neutron stars?
Yeah, so actually I'm about to get to why you want to look at magnetic white dwarfs on this slide. So I think I'll answer both of the questions.
Okay.
So the first place you might want to look for this effect is, say, the sun, because it's relatively nearby, well understood. The sun has a magnetic field of around 10 Gauss, at least a dipole magnetic field. And if you just plug that into the equations I'm showing earlier, you find that the sun lives down here at linear polarizations of order 10 to the minus 14, which is much too small to see. So the next thing you might think is, okay, well, what about the most highly magnetic star that we know of? Here I mean like sun-like star burning nuclear fuel. And that's this guy, HD215441. It has a magnetic field of about 30 kilogauss. And that gets you up to linear polarizations of around 10 to the minus 6. But you can make a generic argument. So during stellar evolution, magnetic flux is expected to be roughly conserved. So BR squared is conserved during stellar evolution. And you can kind of ask for this most highly magnetic star that we know of, as it evolves, its radius is going to change. And under the assumption of magnetic flux conservation, what linear polarization do you expect at sort of each stage of its life? And that's shown by this black line here. At its current stage of evolution, the Euler-Heisenberg term doesn't matter because the magnetic field isn't large enough. So the linear polarization, as I said, goes like b squared r squared. If you plug this in, you find that the linear polarization goes like 1 over r squared, which tells you you want to go to lower radii. You want to look at things that have lower radius. And as you sort of scan towards lower radius, you eventually hit a point where the Euler-Heisenberg term turns on. And in that regime, the linear polarization goes like r to the 2/5 power. So there's this maximum, and where you get the maximum linear polarization, and that just happens by really complete numerical coincidence to lie exactly where magnetic white dwarfs live. Now you can ask about neutron stars. So part of the answer is that they're suppressed by r to the 2/5, which admittedly is a relatively small factor, and they have much larger magnetic fields. But when you actually try and compute this, you realize if you want to utilize the thermal radiation from a neutron star surface, it has a much higher energy than at a white dwarf. And if you go back, if we go back here, in the Euler-Heisenberg regime, you're suppressed by omega to the 4/5 power. So the typical magnetar might be, say, order KeV, temperatures on the surface. And so that's nearly a 3-order magnitude suppression in the expected linear polarization. So that's why this green square for a neutron star doesn't live on this line. So this line is assuming fixed energy, but neutron stars emit at higher temperatures. So you actually lose because of that as well.
The omega that you use there is like the omega that you observe at, or the omega where the photons are mostly emitted?
The omega you observe at, yeah.
So but these magnetars are not optically bright?
Yeah, I mean, you really need to use the thermal radiation so that you don't have a large background polarization. So if something's produced non-thermally, it might be highly polarized. But since thermal photons are just produced randomly, they're really unpolarized. So you're kind of constrained to look at the in the energy range around the surface temperature of these things, which is pretty hot for things like neutron stars and magnetars. Okay, so I initially said that the photons propagate unpolarized from the atmosphere of the star, and that's not exactly true. They are produced unpolarized sort of deep in the atmosphere, but then they propagate through the atmosphere. And you can have some astrophysical polarization created by, for example, bound-free absorption, where you basically ionize a electron and absorb that photon during the propagation through the atmosphere. And at zero magnetic field, the cross-section for this is known. You can just compute it. And in a magnetic field, it's not precisely known. So what people do in the astrophysics literature is they use the linear Zeeman effect. You replace omega energy with omega minus Q times the cyclotron frequency, where this Q is the difference in initial and final azimuthal quantum numbers of the electron. And this is a pretty rough approximation, but it actually is observed to basically reproduce the linear polarization and, well, the flux linear and circular polarization measurements of magnetic white dwarfs, which we have data. And what you expect when you do this is that the astrophysical polarization in the continuum looks something like the magnetic field squared times omega squared, except near regions where you have hydrogen absorption edges. And in those regions, you kind of get funky features that are not so nice like omega squared, but you get sort of rapidly changing polarizations. And what you actually do when you compute the astrophysically induced polarization is you sort of discretize the observable hemisphere of the white dwarf. You compute the Stokes parameters at each pixel, and then you average those Stokes parameters. So you're sort of averaging over many locations on the observable hemisphere of the star. For example, if the star has a dipole magnetic field, has an order one variation in magnetic field over the surface. And so what you actually see at the end of the day for sort of physical polarizations is just a spectrum with a lot of features in it that are associated with these hydrogen transitions. And I'll show an example of this later on. So now we know how to compute the signal and the background components. And we can go out and look for potential magnetic white dwarfs that would be good targets. And there are, as far as I know, there are only 10. All 10 are listed here that have magnetic fields of above about 500 megagauss. And of those, only 3 have archival linear polarization data. So in our paper, we looked at all 3 of these. I'm probably just going to go through the first one, which has the it gives you the strongest constraint on axions. So that's this guy, SDSS J1351. Yeah.
Just to revisit a comment you just made, so we have a background model for the polarization from these white dwarfs, but you already noted that like the actual polarization that you get out of this is fairly messy because it's going to be like a function of the density of hydrogen atmosphere and stuff or whatever path. Mm-hmm. We're just propagating through. So I guess I'll just, is that correct?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I mean, basically you have like a, well, The features you get are essentially dependent on the sort of the bound state energies of hydrogen in a magnetic field, which at the magnetic fields we're talking about can vary quite strongly as a function of field. So we sort of know, we have a template that we know basically what this background looks like. And there's a kind of free parameter that's the normalization, which is sort of the optical depth of the white dwarf. Where, and that's actually, you can contrast that with the axion case, where the axion-induced polarization is energy independent. So you can always sort of discriminate between these two in any case, just using this energy dependence. So first I want to just talk about how we actually know the magnetic field strengths present on these white dwarfs. So in this top panel here, I'm showing the magnetic field plotted against wavelength in angstroms. And this red band here is the magnetic field strength present on the star, given an SDSS collaboration fit to sort of the data that I'm going to describe. This black line here is a particular hydrogen transition line wavelength as a function of the magnetic field. So you can see that it essentially becomes stationary around, say, 600 megagauss. And basically, what you should expect to see is an absorption line wherever this line lies. So if you assume that this white dwarf, for example, has a 761 megagauss field present on the surface, it spans this red range here. And basically, you expect to see an absorption line that has some shape that that looks like this black solid line here. You could also say, well, what happens if the magnetic field is lower? In that case, the absorption line is going to have some shape at lower energies that's not quite as clustered. So you can actually go look at the data and see sort of which one of these is preferred. And here, this is the flux as a function of wavelength, and you see that there's an absorption dip right around 8,500 angstroms, basically where you expect this thing to lie. So this is sort of just a toy example to roughly illustrate why we know the magnetic field strengths present on the star that we cooked up ourselves. But the SDSS collaboration actually did kind of a full-scale analysis using multiple of these stationary hydrogen lines. To determine this 761 megagauss field was present on the surface. So used a lot of these and incorporated some effects that we didn't include here. But just kind of schematically, this is why you expect fields of this order of magnitude.
These stars, you said, you know, it's like thermal emission, you said it's pulsing over time. Is that what you said before?
No, sorry, that was the neutron star. For these, I don't think you typically get large pulsations. Another thing is white dwarfs can be very slowly rotating, have periods of hundreds of years even. And this one is actually one such white dwarf. So you definitely don't see any. But you can see, like, for example, on some of these, they've had polarization observations over, say, 50 years, and you can see that the polarization angle is slowly rotating and determine that the white dwarf is actually rotating like potentially order thousand year period. Okay, so we have some magnetic field model in mind that is just a dipole. It has two parameters, a polar field strength and an inclination angle with respect to the line of sight. And basically, the linear polarization that you expect from a dipole field goes like B naught squared here times sine squared of I. And that's what's shown in the black line here. So that's the expectation for axion photon coupling of 10 to the minus 12 inverse GeV. The SDSS collaboration fit the magnetic field model to the flux state as I described earlier, and the one sigma confidence intervals are shown in orange here. At least, yeah, okay. It's red from this angle, which is interesting. But it is orange for you guys, I think. So in our analysis, we just fixed this magnetic field model to be the most conservative it could be at one sigma. So that's this solid orange line. And what that tells you is that for this guy, the axion photon or the axion-induced polarization you expect is of order 0.04% for an axion photon coupling of 10 to the minus 12 GeV. So you can see that here.
Did you say how they determine this angle? Sorry, I missed
it. Yeah, so the inclination angle is basically, you can vary the inclination angle in the same way as previously. So the fields that are present on the observable hemisphere change as you vary this angle. And that's how you constrain this.
Sorry, I thought you said that they determined the field strength from the location of this line in the spectrum. But how does that tell you, this angle?
So you can only look at one basically the observable hemisphere pointed towards you at any given time. So as you change the inclination angle of the dipole axis with respect to your line of sight, the field strengths on the star vary. So that essentially, I mean, basically, if you look back here, that changes sort of the amount of weighting you do when you weight this line by the amount of the portion of the star that has a certain magnetic field strength on it. And this weighting changes as you vary this inclination angle.
So you're assuming some sort of like pattern on the surface of the star for the field strength.
Yeah, so it's just a dipole.
I see.
Yeah.
And then the emission is like some sort of average over what the part that you're seeing.
Yeah.
And so why then is this like so narrow? I mean, like, I would have thought that if like the field strength is strongly varying over the surface of the star,
right,
it would smear this feature out.
Yeah, so that's exactly what you're seeing here. So for a 761 megagauss field, the field varies by basically a factor of two. And this line, transition line, is stationary around these field strengths. So the only wavelengths that this line appears at is, you know, between like 8500 and or 8550 or so, assuming a 761 megagauss field. Right, so that's exactly what we did to get this feature here. If you go to lower fields, then it is very strongly varying as a function of magnetic field. So the 400 megagauss, that's why you kind of sweep out this range of absorption line energy.
A separate, but maybe somewhat related question. Have they ever tried to do this modeling, assuming perhaps the white dwarf could have a quadruple?
Yeah, not for this one, but people have done that for actually some of the other white dwarfs that we looked at, and changes things by like an order one factor. I mean, you generally sort of expect the dipole magnetic field strength to be the largest and also the most important for the axion emission because it's kind of coherent over the largest distance. But yeah, this is something we're interested in looking at in the future as well. But for this one, they assume specifically a dipole magnetic field, just because you have much less parameters, and they were doing this for some hundreds or thousands of white dwarfs. Okay, so for an axion photon coupling of 10 to the minus 12 inverse GeV, we expect a linear polarization of order 0.04%. And if you go actually look at the data, this is what you find. So this is linear polarization as a function of wavelength. And this data was taken by a Russian telescope a few years back And sort of, there's not really that much data around on magnetic white dwarfs. So we actually just digitized this data from their plot. We're hoping, or in the future, we're trying to get dedicated data. But for the moment, this is just sort of what you're able to work with at this level. But anyway, this is the linear polarization they find. And there's three components that we fit to this data. So there's an axion model, which is just flat as a function of wavelength. Here, the Euler-Heisenberg term doesn't matter, so that's why it's flat. You have an astrophysical component, and that's in this dashed dotted line here. And you can see it has all of these features I was talking about earlier. We didn't find any evidence for that component here. And the reason is essentially that this particular instrument has sort of an intrinsic polarization at the level of 0.4%. So like the instrument itself can be polarized. If you look at something that's unpolarized, then it reads out some number around 0.4%. So there's a systematic uncertainty associated with this instrumental polarization that is really what limits us. So
can they like rotate the instrument again to make it go away?
Yeah, I think if you rotate it, like you disturb whatever's going on, and maybe it's like a different polarization then. So this is something we're actually working with observers now to obtain dedicated data on an instrument that will have much smaller systematic errors of this type. But hopefully with dedicated data, we'll be able to have better control over things like this. But for the moment, we just assume a component that gives you a flat polarization that has a Gaussian prior of mean zero and variance 0.4%. And basically when you do that, you find, you know, this thing is probably, this non-zero polarization is probably coming from this instrumental polarization. And you can constrain the axion photon contribution to this polarization to be less than 1.25% at 95% confidence. And when you map that back onto axion photon couplings, you find this extremely strong constraint that actually by itself just excludes the axion interpretation of these gamma ray transparency anomalies. So it's about 5 × 10⁻¹² inverse GeV at masses below a few times 10⁻⁷ EV. And really is the strongest constraint over a wide energy range, but yeah, also just excludes this axion interpretation. So now we think that this gamma ray transparency anomaly can't be coming from axions, so it's probably coming from some systematic issues associated with understanding the blazar sources, for example. Okay, so I think I'm running out of time, so I'm going to skip the last two. But basically, here, so this white dwarf is what you were asking about. Here they have, or someone has fit higher multiples up to L of 4 to this white dwarf. And we did an analysis assuming both a dipole magnetic field and this harmonic fit. And it changes the linear polarization by sort of an order one number. And that's something we're interested in looking at in the future. So all of the other magnetic white dwarfs we looked at give less strong constraints, although I think they're interesting as kind of toy analyses to see what you could do with this in the future. So right now we're working with an observer at UC Berkeley, Alex Filipenko, who's observing basically the other seven magnetic white dwarfs that have no linear polarization data with the Lick Observatory. And with dedicated data, I think we're going to be able to do more robust analyses where we understand, you know, at a better level the systematics that might be present in the instrument, things like this. And we can also think about contributions to the linear polarization from things like higher order fields beyond the dipole approximation. All right, thanks.
Thank you. Questions?
So the rest of the magnetic white dwarfs you get force constraints just because their magnetic fields are smaller?
Yeah, so their magnetic fields are smaller. Is like essentially the main thing. Or you can be limited by other systematics, things like this. Yeah.
You know how messy like the polarization of the X-ray photons is actually coming in, like are a good fraction of them depolarized or something by scattered out the ISM or you're reading magnetic fields. I understand that the measurement you're making here is based on like the total integrated flux, but is there some sort of, yeah, I guess.
Sorry.
I guess it's hard to quantify.
The photons as they.
As they travel through the ISM, they could like scatter.
So the plasma mass is very small in the ISM compared to, for example, things like the deltas that are in the mixing matrix. So you can basically neglect things like this. And you could also imagine there's, for example, Faraday rotation that rotates the plane of polarization. We calculated this, and again, for the ISM, the electron density is just so small that it's negligible. So the actual rotation you expect is at order 10 to the minus 10 radians, which is well below anything we could measure with these instruments.
So I'm sure that's like a function of the integrated electron column density. And are these really close white dwarfs? Or are they?
These are basically really close. I mean, order 100 parsecs. So the one that I focused on was I think is 40 parsecs.
Your polarization measure. Yeah,
this one.
You do see like if not the axiom, what would explain this?
Just that it's non-zero.
Yeah.
So we think this is just coming from the instrument itself being polarized in this particular observation at the level of 0.6% or so. Yeah. So
the instrument is that dotted line.
No, sorry. This is not very stable. The instrument is a flat contribution. So since we didn't take the data and we don't have access to it really at any level, we don't know what the instrument polarization looks like actually. And the most conservative thing you could assume is that it's as a function of wavelength completely degenerate with the axion model, because then you can't discriminate the two at all, right? So that's what we assumed. It doesn't have to be in practice actually flat. For example, you know, I don't know, these points are high, maybe there's something else going on there, but just because we're working with sort of digitized data, this is the most conservative thing that you can do. But yeah.
What's the difference between your three lines or your constraint? Is it just a what level? Yeah, I don't understand. Why do you have three lines in your constraints?
Sorry, so there's an axion contribution?
You show the constraint in the
box. Oh, okay, sorry, yeah. So, it's different astrophysical, just different assumptions about the magnetic field present on the surface. So here we're assuming the most conservative at, where'd it go? At one sigma, this this sort of solid orange, but you can also be less conservative, assume the inclination angle is 90 degrees, assume the magnetic field's larger. So that's basically the level of astrophysical uncertainty present here.
So I had another stupid question, but why, for the explanation of the gamma ray anomaly, why can I not do the same with the supernova axions? Why, like, I don't understand where the axions are converting back to the photons in our neighborhood.
So for the, well, the supernova axions are emitted at slightly lower energies,
right? Right. So then
and then
the conversion is not going to be efficient enough back to photons.
Yeah, but like supernova 1987A, for example, was in our own galaxy too. So the, I mean, even the optical depth at a TeV is much larger than the distance to 1987A. So you don't expect to really have these.
No, but why don't you get a limit from supernova emission followed by the axion conversion to photons in the X-ray region, for example? Is it just
Sorry,
a conversion process? Back to the photons to the X-ray is not efficient enough?
Yes, yeah, so
very strong.
Okay. Yeah, so you have limits from supernova 1987A, but they're not efficient above like a 10 to the minus 10 EV axion mass or so. The conversion becomes inefficient just because you're trying to convert over such a large distance.
It's too close.
Well, really the problem is like, you don't know the magnetic field of the supernova itself. So when you try and do something like that, you have to convert the axion into a photon in the galactic magnetic field, and that's the large scale. In principle, this would work if you could convert the axion in the magnetosphere of the supernova. But the uncertainties associated with the magnetic field there are large. So yeah, I think that's why you don't have anything like this. Yeah.
More questions? If not, then we thank Chris again.
Thanks.